This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, the top experts, a big issue in 28 minutes, all brought together in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room. This week, what's behind the current protests in Iran and should the regime be worried? We've all seen the images of people, mostly women and girls, protesting on the streets of Iran. The movement even has an anthem of sorts, a song that went viral.
برای توی کوچه رخصیدن برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن برای
It's called For the Sake Of, and it's a long list of all the reasons Iranians have to protest. The writer has been arrested. These protests have their roots in the detention of a young woman for minor infractions of the Islamic Republic's dress code and her subsequent death in custody. But the last few years have seen waves of protest, all of which have been successfully repressed. So this time, is it different? Is a regime that's been in power since 1979 under threat? Step into the briefing room to find out. First into the briefing room with the who, what, when and where is Khosrow Kalbossi, who covers Iran for BBC Monitoring. Khosrow Kalbossi, can you just take us back to how these protests started?
On September 13, Iran's morality police arrested a 22-year-old woman from Iran's Kurdish ethnic minority, Mahsa Amini. When they took her in, according to eyewitnesses and reports that rights groups have documented, she was beaten and allegedly sustaining head injuries. When she is taken into custody a few hours later, she goes into a coma. 3 days later, on 16 September, she passes away. This incident angered the whole nation. Protests erupted at her funeral, with people chanting, "Martyrs don't die," and with her family writing on her grave that she has not died, but will turn into a symbol of protest and resistance. And that's exactly what has happened. The demands of people have gone beyond asking for accountability about Mahsa Amini's death. The people have been chanting death to the dictator. People have been chanting, we don't want Islamic Republic, and other slogans that are going directly after the main pillars of the Islamic Republic.
Now, who, as far as we can tell, demographically, is protesting at the moment?
Like almost all protests that we have seen over the past four decades in Iran, these protests are led by women mainly, many of them Generation Z. But these protests have bridged all class gaps in Iran. In many cases, we see protests erupting at universities and schools. Yes, that's true. But we have been seeing same protests going on around the country in over 90 cities in Iran. We don't see massive crowds of hundreds of thousands marching on streets because security forces are brutally cracking down on people. But whenever people have had the chance to gather, we have seen large crowds forming. It is widespread and people from different walks of life are participating in them.
So where crowds can form, they do, but where they can't, they tend to be kind of small gatherings and so on. Do we have any idea what's happening outside the cities in smaller towns and villages?
The Islamic Republic has imposed a partial internet shutdown in Iran. This mainly targets mobile services, and in rural areas, people mainly rely on mobile services for going online. So this means that in villages and in small towns, most people don't have access to any main communication tools that would enable journalists to have an accurate image of what is happening in these areas.
Now, how have the Iranian security forces responded?
Iranian security forces, including Basij militia, have been using live rounds, pellets, tear gas, and water cannons to suppress these protests. So far, rights groups have documented 154 deaths in Iran during these protests. Among them are five children.
Now, how has the Iranian government explained to the people what is its version of what's going on?
Iran's supreme leader this week gave a speech and said that the whole protest is the work of Israel and the United States. For 43 years, whenever there is any sign of dissent, these same labels are used for cracking down on protesters.
Khosro Kalbousi, now joining me in the briefing room and just back from Iran, is Azadeh Moaveni. She's an academic and the author of Lipstick Jihad, a study of Iranian youth movements. Azadeh Moaveni, you've just got back from Iran. Can you give us a sense of what you've seen and also how it compares to previous protests you've covered?
In Tehran itself, there are nightly gatherings all over the city. They're smaller than the sort of big marches we've seen in years past in 2009, when you had a million people out in sort of central parts of the city. And now it's scattered everywhere, but smaller. And young people are very deliberate about this. They realize that it's harder for them to be chased away by the police. It's not organized in the sense that the demands and the young people out on the street are very much leaderless. What I find extraordinary is the sheer social diversity of the young people and the older people, people in their 30s and their 70s, young women out with their mothers. This is really everyone. And then the other quite striking thing is that you see the results of these protests already changing daily life, seeing young women who cut their hair in protest, shorn, you know, the ends all jagged out during the day in areas of the city where that was a rare thing to see. It's spilling out into daily life already, even though it's not even over.
Why do you think this one particular incident, the death of Mahsa Amini, has sparked a response like this?
In recent years, the issue of dress laws and forced covering, forced hijab, has really receded, I would say, in public life. When I was in my 20s living in Tehran, I mean, I can't count the number of times that I was stopped by the police for the wrong buttons, not allowed into a government building, detained at a checkpoint. It's transformed now in terms of women flouting these dress codes. In the last couple of years, any cafe, restaurant you go to in a lot of the city, but especially the north, women just don't have their scarves on. So there's been a sort of de facto relaxation pushed by young women. And so to see Mahsa Amini, to see a young woman killed, to see the sort of renewed push of enforcement that we've seen under President Raisi. You know, he instituted a national day of hijab and chastity this past July. And there were new patrols of morality police on buses and metros. So I think that many Iranians, especially young women, thought that this phase of the Islamic Republic, where what they had on their bodies could expose them to danger of the most terrible kind, they thought that this was over.
That's really interesting. So in other words, there'd been a de facto liberalisation, and then the regime pushed back against the liberalisation, and the result has been this wave of protests.
Precisely. I think young people get used to rights very quickly, and especially these 20-somethings are just enraged when it's taken away, more so than I think my generation or my mother's generation, of course.
So demographic change is also a factor here.
Yes, Iran has a very young population. It has also a very educated young population. Young women are the majority of university graduates. So they come out into the world with skills and education, and they go into a job market that is full of gender discrimination. Iran is quite patriarchal, but enabled by Iran being very isolated. So you have a clash between a very young, educated society where women especially have expectations of a kind of quality access to public life that are just simply denied them. I think certainly there's a very nihilistic and very radical feel to what they say in these protests. They're definitely projecting a wholesale rejection of the system. But that's partly also because nearly all avenues to change have really been shut down in Iran. You know, elections have become increasingly less meaningful. The independent press has diminished the sort of space that there was in the arts, in politics, in culture for what can be expressed and said has shrunk down. So it's just a cry of pain, really.
Now, one of the things that we heard earlier from Khosrow is that what happens is that demands can alter from talking about things like the repressive dress code to becoming about the regime itself. Do you think that the regime might recognise this at all and say, OK, well, let's be less strict about the dress code so that we stop them then making those other demands?
Certainly that's been the pattern of the Islamic Republic for the last 2 to 3 decades. It's very adept at using its pressure gauge when it feels threatened. What I think might very well happen is that these morality police patrols that picked up Mahsa Amini will be pulled off the streets, that there will be diminished and less enforcement of the dress code, so that much of Iranians will sort of revert to the kind of de facto relative relaxation of recent times. But the system never makes this explicit. It doesn't want to concede. It sees that as showing weakness. And so it just sort of changes policy in practice. And I think it may well do that.
In other words, maybe next year they won't have another national day of hijab and chastity.
Well, they're very attached to having these national days, but perhaps it won't be accompanied by the kind of terrible policing and very arbitrary policing. The arbitrariness of it is quite important. You know, there are neighborhoods, David, of North Tehran that don't experience this. You know, neighborhoods where very well-to-do Iranians, many of them affiliated with the government, with the system, who have very wealthy liberal lifestyles enabled by their ties to the system. And they already have this freedom at all times. And people see that. They see the lives of these young people in their flashy cars and in their pool parties in bikinis. They see this on Instagram and they feel terrible resentment that they have the national day of hijab and chastity while what looks like the children of the system's elite are having, you know, villa bikini pool parties. So I think there will have to be an alignment. You know, I think Iranians want a social contract. They want social freedoms that the elite enjoys for themselves.
Azadeh Moevani, that's the protesters. What about the regime? Iskander Siddiqui is a historian at Goldsmiths, University of London. Iskander Siddiqui, can you just briefly outline for us how Iran has been ruled since the Islamic Revolution in 1979?
As I'm sure many of your listeners know, the Shah's regime was overthrown in 1979. It was very much a popular revolution, constituted of a sort of a large coalition, but obviously the regime that was subsequently established under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini took the form of what is referred to as an Islamic Republic. And the system really has very much dictatorial, oligarchic features, but it has this kind of veneer of the philosopher king. And that's the role which first Ayatollah Khomeini played and then subsequently Ayatollah Khamenei.
Who actually is the boss? Is the president and the parliament the boss, or is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, the boss?
He is ultimately the boss. He sets the main parameters on internal security policy, foreign policy, all these sorts of things. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the Revolutionary Guard. He controls the reins of the judiciary, state television, the intelligence ministry, which is supposed to be really under the purview of the president, but really it's ultimately the supreme leader who decides that.
So we have a supreme leader who really is pretty supreme, but you also have a parliament and president. You have elections. So how much genuine political freedom is allowed in Iran? I mean, for politicians of different kinds of views to stand in elections and so on?
Well, I mean, the Islamic Republic has never been a democracy in a meaningful sense, but I mean, there has been a fair degree of intra-elite competition historically. So you would have a kind of a left and a right vying for power, or a reformist and more right-wing faction sort of battling it out during presidential and parliamentary elections. But in 2009, when Mir Hossein Mousavi stood for the presidency against the incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, because the wide perception of electoral fraud, there was obviously a huge protest movement where people sort of were demanding their vote. And that was quite brutally repressed. So really, since 2009, what we've seen is a kind of a highly engineered set of electoral procedures, and really the winnowing down of that political diversity, even within the elite.
Let's talk a bit about the organs of the state, or the things that the state uses to enforce its will. The one that most notably comes to mind in the context of these protests is the morality police. Who are they, and what do they do, and how is it decided what they do?
They're really there to provide guidance. So if women are said to be, quote unquote, not properly wearing, quote unquote, the appropriate attire, their duties range from basically giving verbal warnings, exhortations, citations, things like this, to forms of manhandling and basically dragging women, kicking and screaming, into vans. There's also a more sort of ominous sort of dimension to this, where modern day surveillance is very much part and parcel of this. So women can actually get sort of citations and fines when driving their cars, and if they're caught on camera not wearing their hijab. And it's happened to my sister-in-law and many others. So there is actually this other element to it, where the surveillance state is also an integral part of actually monitoring women's dresses, even in the privacy of their car.
Finally, Iskander, we have a kind of natural tendency to want the demonstrating Democrats to win out. But how strong is the Iranian system at the moment in being able to resist them?
Khamenei is still alive and kicking. As long as he's alive, he's sort of, in a sense, holding the system just about together. I think we're going to see a lot of protesting ongoing and instability, but I think they will be able to hold on to power for the time being, at least. Following Khamenei's death, when the dictator dies, then a lot of things will be up for grabs.
Iskander Siddiqui, let's throw it forward. Can the regime really continue to resist change? Stepping into the briefing room are Ali Ansari, Professor of History at St Andrews University, and Sanam Vakil, Deputy Director of the Middle East Programme at Chatham House. Sanam Vakil, does the regime by now have a tried and trusted way of dealing with protests?
The government has a playbook that I think it has honed and developed through each round and series of protests, where the government, of course, uses its repressive capacity to crack down and push people off the streets. It tries to rally pro-government demonstrations. It sort of rounds people up, brings them in, warns politicians, journalists, activists to stay off the streets and not incite further protests. There's, of course, the sort of classic Islamic Republic strategy of blaming the West and outsiders for fomenting protests.
Ali Ansari, I take it you recognize the existence of that playbook. Is it still as effective in the world of social media as it has been before?
I certainly do recognize it. I think it just suffers from the law of diminishing returns. The fact that, you know, every several years now they've had to bring out this playbook because of protests that have turned violent pretty quickly is an indication that, you know, in some ways they have to think a bit more creatively if they want to create a degree of stability in the country. One of the things that often even businessmen in Iran would complain about is that every time there is a protest, repression, internet is shut off, business suffers, all sorts of things go haywire. So it's not a sustainable way for the country to function in the long term. But the system, obviously, the priority for them is to retain power.
That's very interesting. I'd not thought about this question before of who else gets inconvenienced when the internet gets shut down.
Yeah. They want, on the one hand, to, you know, say that they're a highly successful, you know, modern Islamic state in some ways. But the fact is, the way they govern the country is deeply problematic. I mean, it's really the imposition of a set of rules by a minority on a majority.
Sanam, we heard from Azadeh Moavini earlier that what may have very well have motivated the beginnings of these protests at any rate has been the fact that there's been a de facto liberalisation about women's dress and things like that, but that the regime had decided to crack down again. Do you think that the protesters would be mollified by a return to a liberalisation of that kind of measure?
I think Azadeh is quite right. For any of us who have traveled in and out of Iran through the years, and we have observed and taken part in that liberalization. But this reassertion of control has been part of that tug and pull between conservatives and, in this case, Iranian women, because reasserting control over the hijab and female dress is about the foundational pillars of the Islamic Republic. And seeing those pillars fray reduces legitimacy. And President Raisi's reassertion of control in this space over the summer is really what charged these protests again. I do think it's going to be very hard for the state to take a heavy hand about the way women are dressing going forward. I think they might modify the way they police the sort of cultural aspects of Islam in society. And there have been hints of that with open discussions that they might alter the way the morality police is regulated or has a code of conduct. They might use technology and surveillance rather than physical people. And I think over time, we will return to a loosening of that space. But I mean, it's a reflection of a four-decade tug and pull over gender laws.
And Ansari, how much long-term stress does that kind of tug and pull and then liberalisation, deliberalisation, protests, etc., how much of a strain does it place on the existence of the Islamic regime?
I think it does. But I mean, I would say, I mean, just to qualify that a little bit, I mean, the de facto liberalisation is something that I think people's society has taken. It's not something that the government has chosen to give. I think we ought to take care not to suggest that the regime itself is becoming more liberal in that sense. It's just really a question of whether it can manage society in the way it wants to. And actually, a proper way would be to somehow sort of meet society halfway, at least. What it's decided to do is not to do that. And I think in many ways, unfortunately, you know, we've gone well beyond now the possibilities of a modest reform in dress codes or whatever, being able to satisfy the populace. I think things have become much, much more tense, much, much more angry. So the idea that the regime now could possibly sort of decide, oh, well, you know, we'll modify this or we'll do that. You know, they want to get face recognition software from China to start monitoring the way women wear their headscarves. I mean, this would be extraordinarily oppressive. It's moving into a totalitarian direction, which I think many people in Iran will reject.
Let's go back to the current protests. There doesn't seem to be any kind of coherent leadership. Is that a problem for the demonstrators, or is that in a strange way a strength?
I mean, it's a paradox, actually. I mean, in some ways it is a strength because the regime doesn't have a particular target to aim for. And it's playbook. I mean, in some ways its playbook is a mistake because it's always fighting the last revolution, which is basically 78, 79. And it's constantly looking for these leaders that it can sort of challenge and imprison and so on and so forth. The fact is, though, also, if you look historically, it's also the case that there have been protests, even revolutionary movements, that have started in a much more amorphous way with a popular uprising that then begins to take shape and have, you know, leaders will emerge. And there's no shortage, actually, of potential leaders in Iran. It's just that we don't have, obviously, the figurehead that you had in terms of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1978. But even he at the time, by the way, people forget, was one of a number of different people who was coming to the fore. Very often these sort of movements only become identified as revolutionary movements, if you can put it that way, in retrospect. I should add, I don't think we're there yet, by the way. I mean, I think people are getting a little bit ahead of themselves when they say that the regime is facing an imminent collapse or anything like that. But the fact is that movements, if you go back to the Arab Spring or you go back, you know, they often have some fairly trivial beginnings and can then gather momentum.
Salam Vakil, is that the way you see it too?
Yes, I think Ali has captured it perfectly. The regime is very effective at trying to target and identify potential leaders. And that's why so much of Iran's civil society is languishing in prison. And through these protests, they did arrest former President Faizer Rafsanjani, and she is seen by some to be a voice of support for the protesters.
Ali, is there anything useful that the West can do? Usually when this question comes up, what people will be keen to say is, given that the regime uses the West anyway as the kind of explanation for why protests are happening, it actually isn't terribly helpful for the West to be seen to intervene.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a very delicate balance. One of the things the West can do is to ensure that means of communication remain open, that means of access remain open. One of the first things the government does in Iran is shut down the internet. So, you know, one of the things to do is to try and maintain those channels.
Let's look ahead a little bit. Ali Ansari, do you think there are any signs of long-term weakness within the regime itself? Because what seems obvious is that some element of support for change will have to come through a split within the regime.
Yes, I think there has to be a degree of elite fracture and disagreement about the way forward. I think you certainly have to see a level of sort of fatigue, shall we say, coming in the security forces, which we haven't seen yet. So if security forces refuse to take orders or start to defect to the crowd and this sort of thing, then the regime will be in very serious trouble. But at the moment, it's been able to maintain a degree of coherence. And part of that, of course, is by showing that it's not making any concession. It is business as usual. It's a delicate balance for them, of course, because the more they do that, it's to reinforce their base, but it can come across as complacent. It may make them complacent, and it may mean that they will miss things about, you know, how these develop. The Shah was very, very complacent about how things were developing. In fact, a lot of Western embassies were very complacent about how things were developing throughout 78. And it was only quite late that people began to realize what was happening. When are we aware that things have turned the corner? It's a very difficult thing to assess, actually.
Sanam, how sustainable do you think the Iranian system is for the long term?
It's very hard to be predictive about that. That's sort of dangerous to prophesize. But, you know, people have been predicting the downfall of the Islamic Republic for 43 years. And I like to think of the Islamic Republic as middle age. And middle age regimes, much like myself, are less are more risk averse and more cautious. And the Islamic Republic is, I think, on the cusp of a transition. Its leadership is somewhat stagnating. Its wheels are definitely spinning. But we're on the cusp of a transition because Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, is quite old, 83 years old. And there is expectation that political transition will emerge once he passes. And there's uncertainty of who would succeed him and what that process is going to look like. There are sort of constitutional mandates that explain what that process is. We have history to guide us, but there's no clear path ahead. And I think that the elected and unelected leaders within the system today in Iran are already in competition to be relevant and to be at the forefront of that leadership transition. So, you know, this is really a fork in the road kind of moment. And perhaps part of the reason that the system in Iran did not unleash lethal force the way it did in 2019 against the protesters is because they're worried about their reputations and their longer-term viability as leaders within the Islamic Republic.
As Saddam says, we're actually in a particularly vulnerable point for them, which is interesting because we may be seeing, you know, a transition to a new leader. And of course, in autocracies, it's a particularly vulnerable point when this happens. So it could be, you know, in terms of what the discussions are going on behind the scenes, which obviously we're not privy to, there could be a lot more, the atmosphere could be a lot more febrile than we imagine.
Ali Ansari there with Sanam Vakil. My thanks to them and Hosro Kolbasi, Azadeh Moabini and Iskander Siddiqui. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirsty Knight, Daniel Gordon and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Neil Churchill and the editor is Richard Barden. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to our look at the UK economy's long-term productivity problem. And there's also a programme about whether Britain might run out of power this winter.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
And we're here to remind you that our podcast, Now You're Asking, is back for a new series.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists, anything really.
And apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help.
But also hopefully entertain.
Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Radio 4, now available on BBC Sounds.